Hello, and welcome to ContraPulse. This is Julie Valamont. This episode, we hear from Lissa Schneckenberger, the talented fiddler and singer. Raised in a small town in Maine and now living in Brattleboro, Vermont, Lissa grew up with music. She began playing fiddle at the age of 6, inspired by her parents' interest in folk music. She played for contra dances for many years as a teen and in her 20s, including with the band Phantom Power. And in 2001, she graduated from the New England Conservatory of Music with a degree in contemporary improvisation. She has been performing and teaching music around the world ever since. Lissa's album Dance features beloved contra dance tunes in a beautiful setting. These days, she performs often with the band Low Lily and recently released the solo album Thunder in My Arms, inspired by her experiences as a foster parent. She has a really interesting perspective on music and a lot of thoughts about community building. It was wonderful to speak with her. Lissa, and welcome to ContraPulse.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Julie.
I'm so glad to have you here on the porch. It is, again, a hot day in the end of July. It's kind of muggy. There's a little breeze, but not a lot. So we'll do our best. Thank you for coming out. I'm so glad that you live nearby.
Me too. Yeah, it's a good nearby to be.
So we're going to talk about contra dance music. And so I would just love if you want to tell us a little bit about how you got started playing for dances, because people who are newer dancers might not have had the chance to dance to your playing, but you have a very long and rich history playing for dances.
Yes, I did play for a lot of dances, although not recently. When I was little, I started taking fiddle lessons when I was 8 years old from a fiddler named Greg Boardman in Lewiston, Maine. And that was exciting for my whole family for lots of reasons. But one of the big reasons was that he would invite us to participate in community events. And that's really sort of my entry into the contra dance world, and also my whole family's entry into the folk scene in general. Greg was part of the Maine Country Dance Orchestra, which was, they were all sort of Dudley Loffman devotees, and they were all kind of peripheral members of, of Dudley's band, and then had kind of branched off to form the Maine Country Dance Orchestra in that, with that ethos. And so I remember the very first contra dance I ever went to must have been the winter after I started taking lessons with Greg. So, I don't know, I would have been 8 or 9, and he did an annual benefit for a bunch of years for Habitat for Humanity, and it was called the Mighty Cloud of Fiddlers. And it was literally just every fiddler you could find in the entire state of Maine, and a bunch of imports from New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And, every fiddler crawled out from under their rock to come out to this this little or big benefit. And it was a big contra dance. It was in Lewiston. I think they had it at, in the Armory Building, or it was this gigantic gymnasium. I mean, I was little, so it felt very, very big. And 100 fiddlers on stage and hundreds of dancers in the hall, and everybody just whooping and hollering and screaming, and So that was my first dance. And I went, I brought my fiddle, my whole family went. And I got, you know, you could just sit up on stage and play along with whatever you knew, or try to learn a tune on the fly, or you could go down and dance. And I think my friend, family friend, Cindy LaRocque, actually invited me out onto the floor for my very first dance. And I loved it so much that I actually asked her to dance with me every dance after that for the rest of the night. And eventually, you know, she was a avid dancer and not a 9-year-old. She was an adult. So she eventually had to tell me that, you know, she wanted to dance with some other people. But that was it. I was totally bitten by the contra dance bug. Everybody has that moment when they realize that they're obsessed with dancing and they just want to do it all the time. And so it happened pretty early for me. And luckily, my family was supportive. And we went to a bunch of dances after that. So the Maine Country Dance Orchestra had a monthly dance in Bodenham, Maine. And we went to all of those. And sometimes I'd sit in with the band and sometimes I'd dance. And then, Scrod Pudding had a monthly dance in Bodenham, Maine also. So we went to all of those. And then as I grew up, as I got older, I started converting all of my friends to become contra dance fans, partly because as I was a young teenager, I needed people to drive me. Eventually, my parents got tired and they didn't want to go to like 2 or 3 dances every week. They thought, you know, one a month, you know, once in a while was enough for them. So I started convincing my older friends that already had their driver's license to go dancing with me, and converted a whole bunch of new dancers that way. And then finally got my license and started driving my friends around. And I formed my first contra dance band, when I was 15 or 16. I met John Cody, who's a great guitarist from Lewiston, Maine. And we kind of formed a band and played for contra dances all through high school and even into college a little bit. The band was called Wake the Neighbors.
Wake the Neighbors. Classic band.
So, yeah. And then, you know, from there, I met David Kaner when I was a teenager. He was doing a gig up in Maine, and through that friend I mentioned, Cindy LaRocque, she was instrumental in me meeting almost all of my folk heroes as a kid. And so she actually hired me and David Kaner for a gig where David was playing guitar and calling for a school show, and I was playing fiddle. And then that was a really important meeting for me. David is so encouraging of young musicians, and I had a great time playing with him. And he started hiring me to come play his dance here in Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Wow. And
that was my first out of state gig.
Yeah.
In fact, he actually set up, I remember it was a tour, like a little weekend tour he set it up with Bill Olson and I so that we could carpool. And we did the Thursday night Cambridge dance and then Friday and Saturday in Greenfield, I believe. And then we drove home on Sunday, and I did a whole bunch of little, you know, weekends like that with David growing up, and made a huge impression on me in terms of like my dance fiddling and ideas about, you know, what makes great dance music and what's fun to dance to, and how to enrich community and how important all of that is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of like, you know, my two contra dance hubs of or orbits of music and dance were sort of Bodenham, Maine, and then, you know, spreading out from there, all the great dancing that was happening around the state of Maine, and then Greenfield, Massachusetts, and spreading out from there, all the great dancing that's been happening in this sort of central Mass, southern Vermont area, southern New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Makes my heart so happy hearing all these names and just hearing this whole story. It's so wonderful.
Well, me too. I mean, it's so lucky that I feel very lucky to have met these, you know, community builders over time who have included me in their communities, because then I feel so rich from getting to meet all of the other people in those communities and getting to rub shoulders with such great musicians. And it's sort of, that's what keeps me going as a musician, is that community aspect of people creating a beautiful experience together, and how that sustains you over time.
Me too.
Yeah.
That's why I do it. But you say it so eloquently.
Yeah, I mean, there's for sure. I mean, I had other, you know, people tried to draw me out down these other paths. You know, I had a classical violin teacher for a little while, and I just couldn't seem to apply myself. I was terrible at it, and I was terrible almost on purpose, because I wasn't practicing, because I couldn't figure out why I should be practicing when there was no jam session to go to.
Right.
You know, where's the dance at the end of the week? Where's the camp, the fiddle camp you want to, you know, there was no social aspect for me in that other realm. And so I didn't do it for very long, and I really didn't do it very well, so.
Yeah, and you were fortunate to really come into contact or, like, get to know some of, like, the real pillars of the community. You know, Greg Boardman, he was one of the founders of Maine Fiddle Camp, which is where you and I got to know each other.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I probably knew you, but that's where I felt like I got to play tunes with you.
Yeah.
And all the fun things that we would do there. And it's just a wonderful, you know, Scrod Pudding and, you know, Bill and Pam and Eric and everybody up there. And I love those people so much. They're so great. And it is such a wonderful community.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Yeah. And that love of the people, it feels like it's this kind of warm globe of good feelings and support, like, that includes the people, and then it includes these musical aesthetics, and it even for me it includes, like, you know, it's a whole sensory experience. So, like, I feel the love for my favorite people, and I feel the love for the music, and then I remember, like, what it, you know, what it sounds like in the hall and the way it looks, you know, like on a cold night when everybody's dancing and the condensation starts to freeze on the window pane. And then there's, like, that's all wrapped up with, like, the smells and the sounds and everything. That's the whole body experience for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And doing it with friends is so important, you know, like bringing friends to the dance and just knowing you're going to see friends there.
Oh, yeah.
All of it together, shared memories with all these different senses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was a kid, I was excited because at the time, all these college students from Bates and Bowdoin College were getting super into dancing. And so, you know, as a young teenager, I just thought, oh, well, that's where the cool people go. And I convinced a number of my my high school friends that was the case. We used to go and, like, you'd think, oh, yeah, we're going to meet all these college guys at the dance. I don't know that. I realize now that was sort of a unique experience culturally in, you know, in the 90s. But that was my experience, so.
Yeah. Were you, when you started learning from Greg, were you already a fiddler, or was this the very beginning of you learning the fiddle?
Well, I'd been taking lessons for a couple years already, but it was more Suzuki-based. Mm-hmm. And Greg actually does some Suzuki-style learning with his students also, but I was with a different teacher for a couple of years, but I already knew I was super interested in fiddling. My mom actually is a huge folk fan, and her best friend from college is a singer and fiddle player. And that's when I first started. It was actually a summer week when my mom's friend Carol was visiting us for a week in the summer, and she had her violin there, and we went and rented my very first fiddle, and she gave me my first lesson. And you know, we had her CDs at home, so I was already listening to that music, and getting excited about it. And we kind of sort of sought Greg out on purpose because we realized that that's what we were all interested in. Mm-hmm. We were excited about it. We wanted to know more of that.
Mm-hmm. And then you played for Contra Dances with Wake the Neighbors. At some point, Phantom Power was a thing.
Yep. Bruce and Sue Rosen are good friends. And when I went to college in Boston, I went to the New England Conservatory. And then while I was there, got into the sort of the Boston Contra Dance scene. And I met the Rosens through a mutual friend. Oh, boy. It's all friend of friend of friend of friend, right? I met Larry Jennings, who was a mover and a shaker in the Boston dance scene. And I met him through David Kaner because I was going to Boston for college. But I also knew I would need a car there because I was planning to gig on the weekends to sort of support myself through school. And so I was trying to figure out a place to park my car. Mm-hmm. So David Kaner introduced me to Larry Jennings specifically so I could do a trade with him. I parked my car at Larry's driveway all through college in Newton, Massachusetts. And I did gardening work, and I helped Larry, you know, off and on with like shoveling and, you know, yard work and stuff, as he was getting older and his health was failing. And then I got to have this car and I could go out and do dance gigs. Like I could come out to Western Mass for dances, and I could go up to Maine and play gigs. And, so yeah, I was sort of, interested in kind of part of the greater New England dance scene, and then met the Rosens, Bruce and Sue Rosen, through Larry, who was a mentor to Sue in, as she was learning how to call. And we just had a great time playing together. It was really fun.
Hmm.
It was just fun. And they were at a different, when we met up, they were in their sort of life progression, their kids had just gone off to college and they were empty nesters for the first time. And I think now I realize they were really excited to get out and play gigs and kind of be, you know, adults and get out and do their own thing. Mm-hmm. And it was great for me just being in college in a new city. It was cool to go out and have a band to play with.
Mm-hmm.
and people that were, you know, they're deeply invested in the Boston dance scene, and so it was really fun to see and meet a bunch of people through them.
I can only imagine. Such fun adventures.
Yeah, and we went on a bunch of tours together. It was cool.
Was it mostly you and Bruce as a duo?
Well, I'm trying to think. My memory is that every time we toured, we always toured with Sue.
Mm-hmm.
And she was always our caller. I always considered her part of the band, mm-hmm. although she didn't play an instrument in our band. She always called. But yes, essentially Bruce and I as a duo, although we got hired occasionally for like a bigger dance weekend that would have a little bit more of a budget, and they would ask us to bring a third person. We went to Alaska once or twice, and we brought a friend to augment the sound, and a couple of the times we played the Dawn Dance, we had a third and fourth person, I think. We played with Mark Roberts once and maybe Stefan Amidon.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I love, duos are great. They're so flexible. You can upgrade or downsize. You know, you've got your core sound and then you can add on if that works.
And of course, I'm especially fond of duos with pianos, just because the piano is such a rich, expressive instrument with such a huge range.
Yeah. Well, and at the time when we started playing together, guitar was a lot more trendy. It was kind of like the fun, the new, exciting backup instrument for dances. And we kind of felt like we were holding it down a little more in the traditional realm, which was fun to do. I like to be oppositional.
Yeah, me too.
I don't know what that is about my personality, but I do enjoy doing the opposite of whatever I think people think I should be possibly doing.
That's great. Bruce also, does he play a little guitar or just you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he, after we'd been playing together for a little while, he did start adding in more guitar. I mean, he's a multi-instrumentalist. He's mm-hmm. so good at, like, everything from the start. He plays accordion, he plays uke, he plays guitar, he plays piano. But in our band at the time, towards the sort of later end of our playing together, he did add in the guitar for a few sets that we worked up together.
Man, I love Bruce's piano playing. It's wonderful. It's fun, it's inventive, and it's still, like, kind of grounded in that New England sound.
Yeah.
As Arthur said, what is traditional? He's like, traditional as of 30 or 40 years ago, maybe, but whatever that sound is.
Right.
Your album, the Phantom Power album, was one of the ones that I learned how to play contrapiano from.
You're kidding me.
No.
Are you serious? That's so cool.
Yeah. I took some lessons from people, but, you know, I already knew how to play the instrument. I've been a classical player for a long time. Also, sucked at practicing. Didn't enjoy it. Funny how I just really want to make music with people. Mm. And I got your album, and I used to play along with all of Bruce's piano parts.
That is so cool. Does he know that?
I don't think I ever told him that, no.
I kind of want to call him after this. Oh, gosh, that is so sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember hearing you guys play back at, I think it was one of, maybe it was after Down East. Maybe you were playing the Survivor's Dance. Mm. And I went to hear you play there. So great. Down East Folk Festival in Maine.
Yeah, I used to love that. Boy.
So then, how did you get involved in Scottish music?
Well, that story's kind of long, too, but I'll try. I won't bore you with all of it. Actually, it's once again thanks to Cindy LaRocque, the aforementioned mover and shaker in the folk and dance scene in Maine. She gave my when I was young, I think I was 8 or something, she gave my family LP of Alistair Fraser and Paul Maclis. I think it was The Road North. And I just became a fanatic. I mean, we were basically stalking Alistair all over New England. You know, we bought all of his records and then eventually later on CDs. And then we would go to anytime he played anywhere, certainly in Maine, but, you know, anywhere we could get to, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, we'd go to the show or the workshop or the festival, and my mom would record the whole set on a cassette tape.
Wow.
And then I would go back and learn all of his tunes from his concert afterwards. And then we went to his, I was 12, and my dad and my brother and I went to his fiddle camp in California, Valley of the Moon.
I've heard legends about that camp.
Yeah, well, that was just that was a real musical awakening for me, for sure. And after that, I went back as much as I could, as much as we could afford as a teenager, and even through my 20s, I just love that camp so much.
Is that where your band Hilaly came from? Is,
like, yeah.
Those friendships there with Hanukkah and
yep.
Laura?
Yeah, yeah. I met some very, very good friends there from even the first couple of years, that was when we were all going for the first time. And there weren't tons of kids then. And so we all kind of clumped together and bonded very strongly. And they're still, to this day, some of my dearest friends, that little core group that I met then. And Hilaly kind of came out of that with Hanukkah and Laura. We all met at Valley of the Moon. And then it's just kind of coincidental. We all ended up in college in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Laura and Hanukkah both went to Berkeley, and then I was a couple of blocks away at NEC, and we were all living, you know, we had apartments around the corner from each other.
Hmm.
And so we were playing a lot of music together all of a sudden. Like during high school, we would meet up once a year at Valley of the Moon, and then maybe we'd go to a Scottish Games and meet up a second time if we were lucky. And then we were pen pals throughout the year. And then once we got to college, we were all in the same city for the first time, and it was super exciting. Just tons of great music and jams and going out, playing in different pubs and trying to sneak into pubs to see other bands play. And that was sort of the fertile ground that Hilaly grew out of. Actually, I feel like it was Laura and I went to, I think we were juniors in college or something, and we went to Celtic Connections.
Yeah.
In Glasgow.
Amazing. Hello, Dump Truck.
Yeah, Laura and I went to Celtic Connections just for fun, and we had another friend in Glasgow that we knew from Valley of the Moon who put us up in his flat, and then we met all of his friends and went to a ton of sessions and got to hear some great music, and it was invigorating.
Yeah, what an experience.
Inspiring. You know, we're sleeping on a friend's couch, playing music every night, and then hearing music every night, and we came home, you know, basically ready for the second semester of music school, just, you know, we just couldn't stop playing music. And we kind of incorporated Hanukkah into our enthusiasm. And, you know, we had learned a bunch of new tunes, and we'd written a bunch of tunes while we were there, and had all these collaborations going on, and we just kind of kept that momentum going, and that's where Hilaly sprung out of.
Wow. How did Flynn get involved?
Well, was a friend of a friend. We were desperate for guitarists. let's see. Originally, Hanukkah and I were doing a joint recital. We had the same violin teacher for a semester, even though she was at Berkeley and I was at NEC. And we decided, you know, it's a lot of work to put on a conservatory recital. And so, you know, we figured, I don't know, we were juniors or sophomores or something, and we figured we'd do a joint half and half recital, and we'd collaborate on some things, and then we would showcase each other on other things. And we did the recital at Berkeley, and then we did a recital in one of the halls at New England Conservatory. And then we thought, we know all these people in the music community around New England, so let's take this on the road. Mm-hmm. It was like probably my first like official tour. And we did a show. Cindy LaRock helped us set up a show in Lewiston, Maine at Bates College. And we had, I don't know, one or two other little concerts, and we needed a guitarist. So We called a whole bunch of guitarists in Boston. We called Mark Simos and John McGann and, I don't know, Brian Hanlon at the time and Michael Carey. And nobody was available for our dates. And so finally John McGann said, oh, you know, there's this great new guitarist who just moved to Boston. He tours with John Whelan. You got to go check him out. And so we called Flynn. And he was available, so he got the gig.
Sometimes that's these little serendipity moments. And now, all these years later, you play with Flynn. With,
yeah.
Flynn and Low Lily.
Yep. Yeah, it's come around. That's how the music scene is sometimes, you know? If you're still in the music scene 2 decades later, you'll probably bump into each other a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
In between.
Oh, man. I think of a lot of this as, like, the heyday of the Boston music scene. You know? It just, like, there are a lot of good years. When I was coming up as a dancer and as a relatively new trad musician, you know, I went to see you guys at festivals, and I...
Really?
Oh, yeah, totally.
This is exciting.
I remember seeing Hilaly. I was a groupie before you knew me.
Oh, my gosh!
And, you know, I just, like, tried to immerse myself in the Irish scene and the Scottish scene just as an observer, and went to sessions at the Greenbrier. I just love how there's the dance community in Boston and then all these different trad communities, mm-hmm. and the way they overlap. They're not the same, and they don't always, like, intermix, but yet there's this wonderful overlap between them.
Well, and honestly, it is actually, I guess I'm not sure if this is still the case, but for a very long time, it was the only city in the U.S. that you could really make a living as a folk musician and center yourself in Boston, because there were so many different real paying gig opportunities. You could play sessions, you could play contra dances, you could play concerts, you could do teaching, not to mention all the colleges. You could do, you know, lessons and teaching at any of the music schools. And so if you were a musician, like, say, Mark Simos or Matt Glaser or John McGann or...
All professors at Berkeley.
Yeah, and all people that decided for one reason or another they didn't want to travel extensively and they needed a home base to continue and a way to continue playing music without, you know, cramping their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Boston is one of the few places you can do that. And that's the case now for a bunch of our peers, for sure, that are making, music their life in the Boston area.
Yeah, and some of those folks have played for dances. Like, I played with Mark Simos for a dance once. He plays for dances once in a while. He's a busy guy, but I think he appreciates it and likes to bring students to learn how to play for contra dances and get that experience. And I think I'm remembering this right, but wasn't Matt Glaser in Fiddle Fever with Jay Unger?
One of my favorite bands.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's, you know, Jay has a long history of running dance camps at Ashokan and with Molly Mason. And so there's this wonderful, like, interconnection.
Yeah.
That isn't always on the surface. So I would love to, thinking about all this, just to talk to you about your fiddle style a little bit. And what kind of things come from being a dance musician and what kind of things come from your Scottish playing or your classical background or anything else you picked up along the way?
Well, I can only guess. It's hard to have perspective when you are yourself. and it's also true that, like, we are not, like, humans love... It's also true that, like, humans love to categorize things. And we love to, you know, to put things into genres, into little boxes and stuff. But life is not really like that. You know, music is organic and fluid, and the experience of music can flow and change. It's very fluid. So, you know, I can make some guesses, but really everything. I'm influenced by all of it. All the things I've done and heard and thought about and people that I've met and people I've played with. But for sure, you know, the Maine Country Dance Orchestra was a strong influence on my playing, as was the teachers at Valley of the Moon and Alistair Fraser. And then I'd say the third kind of major hub of big influence would be, you know, David Kaner and the Greenfield dance scene. And then there's all the stuff that I did in college, which was I did a lot of klezmer music and improvisation. And one of my favorite teachers, Hank Esnetsky, had a huge influence on my playing and how I think about music and how I listen to music. So I guess if I was to think about it myself, I might think of these overlapping circles of influence with, you know, Greg Boardman in the Maine dance scene, David Kaner in the Greenfield dance scene, Alistair Fraser and the Valley of the Moon fiddle camp scene, and then Hank Esnetsky and the college music kind of avant-garde improv scene. And all of those little things, you know, they rub up against each other and overlap.
Yeah.
But dance fiddling wise, I guess the dancers also have a huge influence on dance musicians playing, and I'm sure I'm not excluded from that. A lot of the things you do as a dance musician, you learn to do because you have a positive experience doing it while you're playing for a live dance. While the dancers are responding in one way or another, you make your choices based on those responses, and those choices become solidified more and more over time. So a lot of things, like I tend to play with a pretty strong backbeat, and that is absolutely influenced by all of the hundreds and hundreds of dancers I've played for over all the years. So, yeah, all those dancers, all those feet, all those sounds and all those halls, those have influenced me a lot.
Yeah, you're playing, it's a wonderful combination because it has this beautiful tone. I feel like Scottish fiddlers in general have this very wonderful tone. I don't know what it is about the technique.
Yeah, I have a few favorite tone, you know, beautiful tone fiddlers that I just love. I can't stop listening to them. There are a lot of Scottish players for sure.
And then you combine that with the rhythmicness, that's not a word, but the rhythmicity, also not a word.
The groove?
Yeah, the groove of playing for dances. And also, you know, Scottish music being rooted in dance music also has a very rhythmic mm-hmm. feel to it. So it makes a lot of sense. Do you play differently when you're playing for a contra dance? Like, how would you change the way you play a tune? Or is it mostly you're playing different tunes and that brings out the difference in your fiddling?
I am not necessarily playing different tunes, but I do change my style a little bit. Just kind of going from memory now because I haven't played for a dance in a little while. But I think for a dance, when I think about playing for a dance, I think on a macro level, whereas when I'm playing for a concert or a recording, I'm thinking on the micro level. Mm-hmm. So for a concert or a recording, there are more densely packed details with the assumption that the listener is going to be kind of paying attention in a more focused way, in a kind of a clean and clear listening environment. Mm-hmm. And so there's some, you know, real logistical things, like you don't play the tunes for as many times through, assuming that people are really carefully listening and they might be ready for something new sooner. But then also there's, you know, I might do more subtle types of ornamentation or variations on the tune. Whereas on the macro level, when you're playing for a dance, I tend to make much bigger gestures and they take a lot longer because the dances go on for longer. You have more time. You can play more times through each tune. You can play more tunes in a medley. And I just don't sweat the little stuff as much with a dance. You know, I don't agonize over the perfect medley of tunes. You know, I try a few things and I'm like, okay, that'll be great. And if it's not great, we won't do it again, but we'll just move on to the next dance, move on to the next medley, move on to the next thing. And, dancers are very forgiving. You know, they are having a great time. Like, worst case scenario, they're all still dancing and laughing with their friends. So even if I put together a kind of mediocre set of tunes for them, they're probably, you know, not going to riot.
Right.
You know, so we try to keep focus on the big stuff, the really important stuff, the groove, keeping the rhythm solid, and keeping the excitement up so the dancers feel like that you're invested in their experience, and then you get that back too. It goes both ways.
So much joy. It's so great. So when you say you tend to make a musical decision over a longer period of time,
yeah,
what kind of things are you changing about your playing?
Well, so dynamics are one thing that could change. And for a dance, it might take longer to change over time. I mean, like, dramatic dynamic gestures, not like the micro groove dynamics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, we might start, you know, really, really quiet and stay quiet for a whole time through the tune. And then we might do a crescendo that lasts at least once through or maybe more times through a tune. And then, you know, that crescendo could build into a textural change where once you're up and loud, you could add something in, maybe add in a new instrument or change tunes to kind of boost and lift, or you could add in a more busy backup part. So you could use a long, long dramatic dynamic change and then use that at a certain point to highlight a textural change. And then that textural change might then influence the next dynamic idea you have, or the next tune you want to go into. And I worry a lot less about smaller ornaments, you know, like rolls or triplets or, you know, all those fiddle ornaments. And I rely much heavier in a dance setting. I rely much heavier on just steady groove and double stops, mm-hmm. to enhance and boost the sound.
That's a very David Kaner kind of thing.
Yeah. Yep. And then I end up, I think this is true for many, 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 many dance musicians, but I end up improvising a lot more, mm-hmm. because the tunes go on for a while. And like I said, the dancers are already having such a good time. They're already in their own experience with each other, and they are not listening to every tiny little mistake that you may or may not make on stage. And so it gives you this free rein to mess around a little bit.
Yeah.
And the pressure's off, so to speak. The pressure's dialed down, dialed back.
Yeah.
And so a lot of, I'd be happy playing one tune for 10 or 15 minutes and just messing around with it and improvising. And I don't mean improvising like a jazz solo for 15 right. minutes, but like subtle changes to the melody that could evolve over time and maybe even morph into another tune that would also then keep evolving.
Oh, cool. Do you ever write tunes on stage? I know some fiddlers do that. They'll just make up something.
I have a memory issue in that regard, where I'm quite content to make up tunes, but I don't often remember what I've done.
Me too.
So that's a problem. I mean, like, I forget them. Usually if I've made up an A part and then I go on to make up a B part, I will definitely forget the A part by the next time it's supposed to come around. So, like, unless I have a helper to tell me, oh, you played this, and I'll play it for you now, so I could relearn it from them. I haven't really written any long-lasting, memorable tunes on stage. Mm-hmm. The ones that I end up playing a lot are the tunes that I've written in, like, a quiet moment when I have a recording device or a sheet of notepaper, so I can write it down and be like, oh yeah, that's what I did, that's the part.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you write an A part and then a B part, and then I come around to the A part and I've already forgotten what the A part was.
Oh, for sure. And then sometimes you, like, and also when you're composing something, you have all these decisions to make. You know, do I like that? Do I not like that? Do I want to combine these ideas, or do I want to get rid of that idea completely? And all of that thinking is inhibited when you can't remember any of the ideas.
Right. Yeah. I really, when I'm writing tunes like that, I really have to take myself out of real time sometimes to do it, where I record it and then go back and listen back to the A part and then respond to the A part and record that. Mm-hmm. I have written a few tunes in, like, my backyard and things, or dances. I've written a few tunes during dances, but I only remember the simple ones.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to improvise during a dance. You know, there's, like, improvising within the melody or deconstructing the melody.
Sure.
Then there's improvising out of the melody, like you're talking about, like a jazz solo or something.
Right. You're maybe, like, when you're improvising on a set of chord changes.
Yeah. And then there's all these textural things you can do and not play the melody at all.
And then it's also possible to not do any of that stuff. Like, Tractor Family, I don't know if you've heard them, but I love their dance playing. Judy Hyman is this amazing fiddler, and they don't really do a whole lot of variation. They just truck on and on and on, yeah. in this awesome, just deep groove, and that's also very, very exciting.
A lot of our listeners will probably know Judy Hyman from the Horseflies.
Yeah.
Which has played, they're not really a dance band primarily, but they've played for Contra Dancing at the Dance Flurry and other places for years.
Yeah.
And they're a groove. They're just a groove. You just go in and you groove to it. It's great.
Oh, it's just
such a deep groove.
It's like a meditation. It's really amazing. I think I was on tour with Larry Unger. We did a bunch of tours. I don't know, we were probably driving somewhere really far, really late at night, and he had, like, a bootleg cassette I guess he's in the Tractor family, which is why he had a live recording of them playing for a dance. And it was just like literally the whole entire dance was recorded on a cassette. And we listened to it for several days. And it was the best driving music. Like, it was driving, but also literally we were driving while we listened to it. And it would get us so pumped, get us to the next gig.
Yeah, Larry's another of those players who's just a rhythm machine. He just cranks it out.
Yeah, you really have to be.
And it's a really great foundation for everything else that goes on top of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's also a melody player and a tunesmith, and, you know, he has a vast variety of experience with all sorts of different kinds of music, styles of music. He has a huge instrument collection. But when he's just playing guitar, he is just a rhythm machine most of the time. And I think less is more sometimes, you know, like that role.
Yep.
Don't worry about all the other stuff and just crank out really good rhythm while you're there.
That less is more idea is one of my favorite moments in workshops that I teach sometimes, where I'll be working with a group of, most often a group of fiddle players or dance musicians, and working on improvisation. And we'll go through a bunch of exercises, all these different ideas and things that we're working on, and trying out different things. And then we'll get to the point where I'll ask them to take stuff away. And that's always, always my favorite part in the workshop, because it starts to sound so exciting. and it's an aha moment so often. Yeah, you know, like, everybody's working so hard in the workshop to come up with new stuff and to internalize these new ideas and to really remember what you're talking about and what you've been doing together. And then you ask them to take stuff away, and it's like the light bulb goes on, their mind clears, and all of a sudden you hear the music. Mm-hmm. Super fun.
Yeah. It's also about giving your brain permission for what you're doing to be enough.
Yeah.
You know, I always have this feeling of, should I be doing something more? Is this good enough? Like that little voice in my head.
Oh boy.
And
oh man, this is now morphing into therapy session. I could sure use this conversation.
Yeah, Lisa, what do the voices in your head say while you're playing music?
Oh boy. Or just, you know, in life, boy. I guess this is a common American problem, but yeah, being okay with what is happening right now, this is enough.
Yep.
What you're doing is enough. In fact, it's often more than enough.
Yeah. And often a good tune is enough.
Yeah.
And I know you love a good tune. So I'd be curious to ask you, what are some of your favorite tunes to play for contra dancing?
Oh, boy. Sometimes it depends on the mood and the dance and the situation and the caller and the crowd. All those factors definitely influence my choices of tunes. And they also change my experience of the tunes, but there are some tried and true, no matter what, they always just make me happy. Huntsman's Chorus is one of them. Never fails. I love it so much. I actually learned that at Ashokan Northern Week with Jeremiah McLean, because he thought I did know it. This happens a lot, where Jeremiah will be like, oh, yeah, you know this tune, no problem, right? And he starts playing it, and then I think, well, that's a really great tune. I want to know that tune. And that's how I learned Huntsman's Chorus. And boy, I just don't think I'll ever stop playing it. It works so much of the time.
And you ended up recording it on your album Dance.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That was this whole exploration of tunes like that, that the sort of often are kind of magical one-tune wonders. Mm-hmm. Melodies that just sustain you and support the dancers and keep you interested over and over and over again that you just love. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Huntsman's Chorus was kind of near the beginning of that journey for me. I heard that tune and I thought, oh, that is just magical. I'm going to play that for the next few months without stopping. And then I discovered there was a dance that went with it, and that was very magical. And then I thought, well, what else is there that's like this?
I think that's one of the wonderful things that you do is you like see the magic and the beauty in some of these tunes, and you just naturally bring it out in your playing. Like Huntsman's Chorus could also objectively be kind of a dorky tune, although I love dorky tunes. Yeah. You know, it doesn't have to be beautiful per se. It can also be rousing and sprightly, maybe. Yeah. But on your dance album, you're kind of showing these tunes like it's like they've gotten, I don't know, they're just a different, slightly different facet of them.
Well, so here's my philosophy about a good tune. The thing for me personally that makes a really, really good tune is that it can wear many different costumes. It's super flexible. It can put on the dorky tune hat, or it can put on the elegant tune hat, or it can put on, you know, the boisterous tune hat, whatever. It's got all these different flexible personalities. It's like the friend you want to bring to any party. Like no matter who else is at the party, no matter what the theme of the party is, you want to bring this friend because they are the chameleon that will get along with everybody. That's how I feel about it. That's like my definition of a good tune. And yeah, and that's true. Huntsman's Chorus could wear many hats. And a lot of those, the dance album tunes, I feel like, I guess I felt like I just wanted to show people a different costume on some common recognizable tunes that maybe people had an assumption about the tune or how it was supposed to be played or how it's you know, what makes that tune fun or not fun or whatever, or that dance exciting or not exciting. And I just thought, well, let's put on some other costumes on these tunes and see how that feels.
Yeah, you're recording a Petronella. It's so beautiful.
Thanks.
I mean, a lot of these tunes, a good tune, I feel like, is also sometimes naturally trance-like. Unless mm-hmm. it's a rag or in that vein where you're not going for that kind of feel.
Yeah.
But enhancing that, you know, Bethany Wakeman plays guitar, right?
Yep. Yeah, she was actually really the driving force behind that arrangement. I think it was one of the first things that we worked up together as a duo when she was fresh out of college and she had just moved to Boston. And I guess I wasn't living in Boston at the time, but I was going out to her place to work up some tunes and rehearse a little bit. And yeah, and I think I'd sent her a really terrible demo recording of me playing Petronella by myself, just like solo fiddle, like 10 times through, which I will do to collaborators on occasion. And so she had taken that kind of scratchy sounding recording and had put this guitar part underneath it that changed the whole feel completely. And it also changed it from a tune that was oriented around two beats or, you know, every measure. And it became a tune that was oriented around much larger phrases where you were thinking about four measure phrases or whole A part phrases, because her harmonic motion changed on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And then that basically birthed the entire arrangement. We were like, that's the core of the arrangement. That's what we're going to build onto.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like Dadgad guitar is especially well suited for that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much, there's so much resonance in the tuning and so much that you can do moving against that resonance. I don't know. It seems to make people really want to move in slower harmonic progressions, mm-hmm. because it just is so glorious when you have a really resonant chord or instrument that's tuned with all these strings humming and buzzing all the time. You just want to keep them buzzing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a long tradition of playing tunes over drones, you know, a lot of like Scottish music, a lot of other kinds of music. Mm-hmm. And I actually love that, because then the moments of the melody make a harmonic tension over the tonic or the fifth or whatever you're droning on.
Yep.
And so the tune has all these different inflection points.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's been one of the real traditional ways to experience Irish music, which was more almost all entirely melodically based before the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Drone and melody.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good sound.
Yeah, I still love that sound.
Kind of vibrates you physically. You know, it vibrates on an inner, a real gut level. There's like a physical experience of it.
Yeah, and those tunes they're not always about the chords. You know, it's about something else. It's like the melody has moments of tension and resolution in and of itself without needing cadences and chord progressions to do that for it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, well, for me, I feel like it's really, for me personally, I feel like it's a way to recognize and experience just sound waves rubbing up against each other. You know, when you're in an open tuning, you're usually working with perfect intervals and then a dissonance. So like perfect intervals, when you see them as sound waves, they literally fit together in a very pleasing way, and that like makes your eardrums feel something. Mm-hmm. And then when you give, you know, when you do a second, a minor second, or a dissonant interval against that, again the sound waves like rub against each other, kind of bump against each other, and they don't fit perfectly, and your ears can feel it. You feel the vibrations in your head. It's super cool.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Joni Mitchell used to call those, she has this word, chords of inquiry. You know, because when she was doing a lot of her guitar tunings are open.
Yeah.
And then she would do a dissonant thing, a moment of dissonance, and she'd call that a chord of inquiry, right? Where it catches your ear, and then you're waiting for the next statement.
Mm-hmm.
Musically speaking.
Yeah, Joni Mitchell's guitar tunings, that's a whole other, we could talk about that for an hour.
Well, see, honestly, I really think that it is in some ways a full circle. Like I know that Joni's guitar playing was a huge influence on some of the earlier Irish guitar backers in the traditional music scene. I remember talking to Dahi about that, and some of the albums that he made like really, really early on, when guitar was not typical in Irish trad music. And then fast forward to like the contradance scene in New England in like the 80s and 90s, when all of those Irish trad albums were a huge influence on the musicians here. Mm-hmm. And thinking now about sort of either guitar, dadgad guitar style, or that open piano style where you have like a droning, a droning tone in the left hand, and then you move the chords against mm-hmm. it with the right hand. Like it feels like a big circle from Joni Mitchell around through all these different genres. I don't know that it's going to go back to Joni, but maybe it's more of a spiral than a circle necessarily.
Right. Right. But things influence each other in interesting ways, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that drony piano style is something that is now kind of a classic part of like the New England piano sound. I've heard Bruce Rosen do it.
Yeah.
Mary Kay Brass, who I learned a lot from, would do it quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and she was also influenced by dadgad guitarists.
Yeah, she talks about that a lot. I hope you get her. You should get Mary Kay on this podcast.
I'd like to.
She's got some cool things to say about how she developed her piano style and who she was listening to. And it is sort of an opposite sound to the older piano style, which we like to call boom chick.
Right. What people might think of as Bob McQuillan's playing, or if you think about like the sound of the New England Chestnuts albums and Rodney Miller's playing on that album.
Yeah. Which is more like boom chick, like left hand, right hand, left, right, as opposed to, you know, something droning in the left while something changes in the right.
Yeah. Do you like playing to the more boom chick style?
I like it all.
Yeah. It changes the groove, I find.
Yep. Yep. It changes the tunes I choose, too.
Uh-huh. Some tunes... I feel like there's some New England tunes that don't fit very well for a droney style. They have sort of built-in chord changes.
Mm-hmm.
And they just want to be boom-chicked under.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, like, on the dance album... I forgot. Arthur Davis and I were talking about the tune Mountain Ranger.
Oh, yeah.
And when I went to re-listen to Dance, I forgot that it's on your album.
I love that tune so much. Geez, that Dance album was, well, influenced by lots of things, but that medley, I got Mountain Ranger. I just learned it out of the New England Fiddler's Repertoire book, which was, you know, put together by Randy Miller. And I learned a whole bunch of tunes out of there. Mm-hmm. And I don't normally learn tunes from the sheet music. That's pretty unusual for me, which is, I guess, maybe just a sign of what a great tune book that is.
Mm-hmm.
So that book helped me put together a number of sets for the dance album.
That's wonderful, though. I mean, like we say, it's a really magical thing to be able to learn a tune from someone and learn their inflection, how they play it, and kind of pass that down. But also, there's a lot of tunes that kind of get accidentally forgotten, and tune books are really great ways to remind us of them.
Yep. Yeah, what a great tune.
Yeah. Also, you have Rory O'Moore on your album.
Oh, yeah.
Which we've heard at the beginning of this podcast.
Oh.
Your treatment of that was a little unusual.
Yeah. What was that? That was, I composed this whole middle section, sort of a through composed. I was working really hard to create a triumph of the human spirit feeling, you know, and I thought, well, this tune could be like we were saying before, it could wear different hats. It could be super dorky. It could be boom chicky. It could be many, many things. But then it's got this minor major shift. Like right, the A part is pretty. It's A major, mm-hmm. right? And then the B part could go in many directions. And I thought, well, what if we just play with the minor vibe for a long time, and we just keep that going for a really long time? And that kind of then prompted me to come up with this whole other, basically, whatever, very long tune in the middle that is a kind of a palate cleanser
mm-hmm.
to the Rory O'Moore that then happens afterwards, which is more major key vibe. And I was sort of copying some other friends of mine at the time that were making instrumental music in other genres, you know, like Hanukkah Castle or some of Alistair Fraser's older albums, and thinking about ways to bring the listener on a journey, whether they're sitting down listening to a CD in the quiet of their own home or they're in a dance hall. Like, you kind of emotionally, when you're listening to music, you want to feel like you're going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the compositional tactics I employed mm-hmm. to go somewhere with all of the listeners together.
And that's definitely something you'd hear in any modern contra dances, where there's more arrangements and the arc has a feeling of going somewhere. And I think modern dancers really like that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's just storytelling, right?
You
read an epic novel and you really want to feel like there's this theme where the main character goes off on a journey, on an adventure, and then all these things happen that change their view, and they have, you know, new thoughts and new experiences, and then they come back home again, but they're changed.
Right.
Right. And so, like, you can kind of do that instrumentally as well.
It's like every contra dance is just the Lord of the Rings.
Yes, exactly. That's right. We're in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
16 bars at a time.
Right.
32 bars at a time.
Yeah, and just because I'm piano-centric, and I don't mind making this podcast piano-centric, this is a sidebar. You know, you've mentioned The Road North a couple times, but that is a watershed album for a lot of people who discovered that, you know, that music, Alistair's music, Scottish music, and also for piano players. Like, for me as a piano player, that was a watershed album
Paul Macbeth. I love him so much. Da, 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 da. I literally have some of his solos memorized.
Yeah, I think I went through and I memorized all the piano parts of that entire album.
We should play that. Can we play that album? I'll play the fiddle parts.
Oh, that would be so great.
My brother and I used to do that when we were kids, actually, and he would play the piano part and I'd play the fiddle part, and then eventually my mom made us stop playing together because we had too many fights over what was actually supposed to be happening on The Road North. It was literally one of the most major sources of family strife as a child.
That's a great story. That just tells a lot about your family and your childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my brother doesn't really play music very much anymore, but if we do play together, the thing that we both still remember almost in its entirety is the Road North.
Yeah, like at BCM Fest, the Boston Celtic Music Festival, didn't like Flynn Cohen and Matt Heaton always and other folks always put together some album concert every year where they would play a whole album?
Yeah. Oh boy, they did. One of my favorite ones they did was, they did the Paul Brady, Andy Irvine duo so well.
Oh.
All those classic old traditional Irish songs.
So good.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually have a Paul Macbeth story. I was on tour with Phantom Power with Bruce and Sue in California. We were doing, I don't know, 1 or 2 weeks of contra dances all up and down the West Coast. And I can't remember where we were. It might have been Santa Barbara or something. I forget where Paul Macbeth lives. Might be Santa Cruz area. Anyway, we were playing a gig. We're just in the middle of it, playing tunes and calling dances. And then Paul Macbeth shows up. And he came right up to the stage and he said, "Wow, you guys sound so great." And I said, "You're Paul Macbeth." And I like almost peed my pants. I was so excited. And then I was like so terrified for the rest of the gig. I was like, well, wait, how many tunes from The Road North are in our set list tonight? You know, like maybe we should change it. Like, I don't want to be like such a dork. You know, like I don't really want to like, but I mean, I told him, he was like being very kind and complimentary and telling us how much he was enjoying the music that night. And I mean, I told him I was a huge fan and I loved his playing, and he was very humble and sweet. But that whole night I was like so nervous, more nervous than I have ever been for any dance ever.
Yeah.
Just thinking, oh, he heard that note. Let's see. Oh, he heard that note too. I'm sure he was not concerned in the slightest.
Right. I'm sure he loved the whole thing.
Yeah. Right. Well, and since then, he's actually come out to a few gigs, but he's always very kind. But I've had to work on my nerves in front of my heroes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I find even interviewing my heroes, I get a little tongue-tied.
I should start a podcast. Now, that would be fun.
I would listen to any podcast you make, Lissa.
I'm going to interview all my heroes.
Yeah, seriously. I would totally listen to that.
We'll see. We'll see. I have a few other brainstorms I need to see through first.
Yeah, a few other irons in the fire.
Thank you.
remember, and tell me more about this, but I remember hearing that you used to go to the Ralph Page archives.
Oh, yeah.
And do research up there.
Yeah, geez, it's funny. I was actually just thinking about that because I have an old, old computer and it's full. And every day it gives me this error message that says, you do not have enough room on your computer. There's not enough disk space or whatever for whatever thing I'm trying to do. And so I was actually going through a folder I had called Listening. Mm-hmm. And I'd made a bunch of Word documents as I was listening to all these different archived recordings. And I just opened them up yesterday to say, like, do I need to save these? And then I actually decided, yes, mm-hmm. I really do. Mm-hmm. I need to save these documents. And so actually I went to the Ralph Page Library at UNH, and I also went to a few other places. I went to hear some private record collections. Frank Farrell is a great fiddler up in Maine, mm-hmm. who has an unbelievable audio collection of maritime fiddling. I've never seen such an amazing room full of records, tapes, and CDs. And Peter Urensky also played me a bunch. He's got a very extensive collection of tapes and LPs. And then Ralph Page Library at UNH, which is just an amazing resource. And then there's also a folk archives up at USM, the University... University of Maine in Orono.
Hmm.
Has a folk archives that was started by an ethnomusicologist named Sandy Ives, who was a professor there. And yeah, just, wow. You know, you could spend years and years listening to all the amazing music that has been collected. And it gave me an opportunity to hear a lot of older style dance musicians and also ballad singers. And also to hear interviews from those people. And it was really interesting. I kind of got into it sort of because I was teaching. And I was teaching a lot of workshops and private lessons. And people would ask me to teach them about the New England fiddle style. And I certainly had lots of ideas from playing gigs and playing contra dances and playing with all of my heroes and mentors. But then I thought, well, if I'm really going to be some kind of authority, I better do my homework. Mm-hmm. It felt irresponsible not to. So yeah, I did a lot of listening to older style dance bands, and that was a huge, huge part of the dance album also that I ended up making.
There's a lot of classic New England tunes on there.
Yeah, and I was curious, you know, we have these ideas from one decade to the next, you have an idea about what is modern, what does that word mean to us right now in this context, and then you have an idea each decade about what is traditional, and the truth is that those meanings, the definitions of those words change over time, and so I just was kind of like, well, I think I know what a traditional fiddler sounds like, but let's actually go see. Mm-hmm. Let's go hear it. Let's see how far back I can find a recording. And anyway, there's all kinds of cool things out there to discover.
Yeah. Who are some of the bands that you were listening to?
Let's see if I can remember. Well, I did a bunch of, you know, there's a bunch of Ralph Page stuff.
Ralph Page Orchestra?
Yep. Ralph Page was a music collector. Well, the UNH Folk Archives was started because Ralph Page donated his entire library to the university, and then they had to put it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the seed that started. And now many people have since then donated more recordings. But Ralph Page had a huge record collection of all different kinds of music, but plus he also published a ton of music. The Ralph Page Orchestra was well recorded, and he was selling his records to people that wanted to be able to dance at home. You know, he couldn't be everywhere at one time, so he would record the band and the calls, and you could just put the record on and have a little neighborhood dance. And so he had a bunch of those that he was selling, and then he also was recording live music at different events, like had all these different old recordings of stuff that he just collected. So that was all kinds of cool stuff. Mm-hmm. I also really enjoyed hearing some of the early 80s dance bands, like all of the musicians that I had met and played music with, but it was really exciting to hear them in their younger days, mm-hmm. playing with different people. I heard a lot of, you know, Bob McQuillan.
Apartment one.
I got to hear a lot of, like, Bob McQuillan and Dudley Laufman, all the Canterbury Dance Orchestra stuff when it was first starting, which was interesting to me because I felt like I had a personal connection to it, and I wanted to be a fly on the wall, so to speak, before I was actually in the scene.
mm-hmm.
So that was fun. And then there's a ton of other stuff that I can't remember everybody's name, like just random recordings from dances and in people's kitchens from all around New England. Just everybody was making music at one time, and it felt like you get to hear these little pockets of a captured moment, sort of a captured moment from that time before radio and then eventually TV kind of took over, and when you might be out in a rural New England community and the dance was still the happening thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were some communities, I just find this still blows my mind, there were some communities like in New England, rural New Hampshire, where there were dances happening 6 nights a week in the middle of nowhere, and they were packed, you know, like,
yeah,
you could have you know, you would never even have to go on tour if you were the dance band in that town. You just play every night and people show up and dance.
It's the thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not a lot else to do.
Anyway, it's interesting to think about what that was like.
Yeah, there's a lot of recordings that are just on these old vinyl records.
Mm.
And, you know, some folks have digitized them, and there's just a lot of history out there
mm-hmm.
waiting. You know, Ralph Page, of course, was a big figure in the Boston dance scene for many years, and you know, so many people came through and played in his orchestra, and
mm-hmm.
Just really interesting stuff.
I'd say one of my favorite little gems from that whole time that I was exploring and listening to older recordings, to this day, like if I had found nothing else, it was worth it, because I found this recording of Duke Miller calling Money Musk to a live band. It was in a hall. You can hear the sound of the dancers, and he sings it, which, you know, I'd heard Kate Barnes do at gigs, mm-hmm. but it was always like kind of a joke-ish nostalgia thing for Kate to who was remembering like Kate's early beginnings of dance band playing mm-hmm. or dancing. And dancing to like Ralph Page and Duke Miller and all these older style callers that would sing the calls to these classic dances. And I just love this recording. It's so beautiful. Duke Miller is this New Hampshire caller.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really very cool sounding.
That's so great. I love that you've taken the time as a fiddler and just as a human, as a musician, to kind of delve into this history a little bit. I mean, the Ralph Page archives are there. Anyone's welcome to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what their pandemic protocol is, but there's just so, and honestly, the libraries are there for people. They love people to come and to enjoy them and to listen and get excited about music. All these different places. Yeah.
And then there's the Ralph Page Dance Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been to that? You played it that weekend, I'm sure,
mm-hmm. in the past. Yeah, I've played there a few times. At least once with Bruce and Sue. Maybe some other bands. I don't remember.
I love that weekend.
That's actually the first time I got to hear your music that I remember dancing to and just being super blown away.
Talk about coming full circle.
Yeah, I was like, I remember being there and dancing and being like, oh.
Was I playing there with Nor'easter, probably?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, that was a great year.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I was blown away by that weekend the first year I went. Before playing there, you know, I just went as a dancer. And it was a transformational experience for me as a dancer. Because I got there and I didn't know a lot of people. I was meeting people in the community, but I didn't know everyone yet. And I was like, oh, this is a more mellow crowd. Like, coming from Boston, dancing at the VFW where I used to dance, like, a more high-energy style of dancing, I come there and I'm like, oh, am I going to be bored here? And then after 10 minutes, I was like, oh, actually, this is pretty great. And then about half an hour in, I just had this kind of transcendent realization where I was like, oh my goodness, the whole hall is dancing together.
Yeah.
We're all moving together. And instead of everyone being really focused on their flourishes, everyone was just doing the choreography together. And my partner would guide me in the right direction for a hey instead of spinning me out into left field and
into the wall or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt like supported and connected.
Mm-hmm.
And the music in general is amazing. You know, they get a lot of the best musicians from New England to play there.
Yeah.
And I think Air Dance was playing, or, you know, one of Rodney's bands or something. Maybe you were playing, and it was just, it was just great. It really changed for me my perception of what contra dancing can be. And so I highly recommend that everyone go. And that's where you can meet a lot of these folks who know some of this, like, older history of, like, New England contra dancing, especially the New Hampshire and Massachusetts roots of it. A lot of these folks are there, and you can just sit in the hallways and talk to them. I used to, that was when I first worked up the nerve to say hi to Bob McQuillan, which is kind of a terrifying experience. I went up to him, and he was sort of half asleep in the chair, which he often was, and because he was quite old at this point, and I said, "Excuse me, sir." Which, of course, anyone who knows him knows how ludicrous this whole scenario is. And I'm like, "Excuse me, sir." I was like, "Do you teach piano lessons?"
Ah!
And he's like, "Piano lessons? No, get out of here. I don't teach no lessons." And I was like, "Ah, okay, okay." And so I left. And then someone else is like, "No, you just, he's joking with you. You got to ask him again." And I went back and he was so friendly and he gave me his card.
Aww.
And, you know, Peter Urensky's always there, and Peter, like you're saying, has a lot of stories. He loves these classic New England tunes and has a lot of stories about them. And
Well, and he's done, he's got a lot of archives written down, just, like, transcribed in great detail, a lot of this old music. It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, boy, that Bob.
I mean, he used to teach at Maine Fiddle Camp for years. You must have some good stories.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Actually, you know, it's funny. So, you know, it's funny because he lived in New Hampshire and I grew up in Maine. And but oddly enough, the first place we met was in Washington State. No, met in Idaho. We were both hired to play at the Lady of the Lake Dance Week. Maybe Larry Unger was there also. Somehow I got into this band with Bob McQuillan and we met for the very first time there at the beginning of the week. And he, I can only imagine how he would have responded when you said, "Excuse me, sir."
Right.
His favorite greeting was, "How the hell are you?"
Exactly.
And he liked very much to use foul language whenever possible. But fun guy, really fun.
And then
once we met out there, then we had this connection, musical connection, and we got to play a bunch more dances in New England together also.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know, I was just thinking about sort of talking about the archives, the Ralph Page archives, and then a few of the other libraries. And the one thing that I've been thinking about now in retrospect is that there is, at least in the library archives that I've gone to, there is an absence of mention of like indigenous and Black American musicians in the scene, which is odd. And it's worthwhile to say that because I think for anybody that's listening who's thinking about going to these places, it's I guess it's important to consider that, you know, that we're not all just white people in this little bubble, even though it has been felt like that for a long time. And I actually regret not asking more questions about that when I was in research mode, and you know, asking specifically for other types of music and other musicians that weren't represented in my research. And there's an opportunity there for people that want to do more research now. which is kind of exciting, you know, to ask those important questions about all of the different people that have been making music in New England over the past, few hundred years. So that's something that I'm contemplating and thinking about a lot now.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's really important to consider. I mean, history is a funny thing, right? It totally depends on who tells it.
Yep.
And what we choose to save and who we acknowledge and mm-hmm. who feels welcome participating in something. And
even, you know, who's doing the collecting. So, you know, Ralph Page essentially started the Ralph Page Library at UNH, and he was a white man. And Sandy Ives essentially started the folk archives at the University of Maine in Orono, and he was also a white man. So that's, you know, just to say, take it all with a grain of salt.
That's right. It is some of our history, but it's definitely not the definitive history. And it's easy to forget that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of untold parts of things. Yeah.
Hey, I also, not to abruptly change gears slightly, speaking of my Dan's album, I wanted to tell everybody who's been listening to these podcasts that I have two sort of secret unreleased tracks that I recorded back when I recorded Dance, and I'm actually giving them away for free right now for anybody who wants to sign up for my mailing list. Aww. On my website. So if you go to lissafiddle.com, LISSAFIDDLE, there's a place to sign up for my mailing list, and anybody that does gets these two free MP3 downloads with two more classic Dance tracks. I think one starts with Haste to the Wedding, classic Dance and Jig, and then the other one is Hole's Victory.
Yeah!
Which I love, so I just love that tune. And it broke my heart not to include them on the Dance album. It really was just too long. You know, like, too much cake can make you sick. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to make anybody sick. I really wanted them to appreciate this beautiful music. So anyway, I have these free tracks floating around that are just kind of special bonus tracks for anybody that's curious.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing those with us. And thank you for all your amazing playing and the joy that you bring to the dance floor.
Yeah, well, it's fun to talk about all the dances and dance music with you.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
Well, now I'm craving cake, but...
yeah, right.
I don't think that's what you meant. I can't think of anything. I mean, yeah, I'm just appreciating this podcast and also your other podcast that you have been putting together, and just appreciating the work you've been doing.
Oh, thank you.
As an artist and a musician and an appreciator of the arts.
Well, thank you so much for your time and energy and stories, Lissa. I really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit ContraPulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!